Hello, and welcome to the 11th Millennial 2016 Hangout, and this is with Eric Orwell. I've been aware of Eric for, well, since before I started my channel. Before I started my channel, there was the Theden.tv website and several other blogs and several YouTube channels, and Eric's was one of them. And what I then believed was called the Reactosphere, and I think it was the Reactosphere. I think that was accurate. And then I started my channel. I've been aware of Eric for a long time, but we've never spoken before, and we've never done a hangout before. So welcome, Eric.
Thank you for having me. I really do appreciate what you've done with your channel and the connection I think that it's brought between many of these speakers who otherwise wouldn't have that common ground, and I think you've served that platform need that really I did feel going into it. When I started this, I was not a white rights advocate or identitarian or anything like that. I actually started a personal philosophy channel, and this community approached me, and so I understand very well the process that is going along in many people right now. In the alt-right, kind of waking up to the whole question of heritage and tradition. And really, there are very good arguments to back what this whole phenomenon is about. And really, to get down to it, it's a matter of subjective preference. You know, that's where it comes down for me. I love Western culture. I trained as a classical musician. I played the French horn. I love Western philosophy. And when I was younger, when I would watch comedy, I appreciated typically white males. And I don't think that was some kind of wrong on my part. I tried very hard to keep an open mind. But there is something to this kind of group identity that is natural and satisfying. And I think that's really what it comes down to. We need community. I think that's built into who we are as humans. And the modern leftist narrative is all about creating your own identity, and they play this game of identity politics, but there's this one conspicuous absence, this one proscription, which is you cannot identify with that which is the most natural to identify with, your people. And
You're non-white.
Right. But even then, I think they view that in the context of thinking that, you know, given what they have been through historically, they have to go through a transition where they're able to bring each other up. So some of your previous speakers have made the point, Greg Johnson, who I greatly appreciate. I think he is a great, he thinks in terms of institutions. He's very productive in his mentality. So I have a lot of appreciation for his way of thinking. And one of those comments was that when you bring in an outgroup and they naturally identify with each other into a society that believes in individualism, it's game theory. They will naturally preponderate in the economic system and elsewhere. But I think the liberal doesn't have a problem with this, you know, because it's a matter of correcting historical imbalances and injustices. And, you know, I think that there's a level of appreciation that I do have for that position. The globe is becoming integrated. And I think that's my position here, is that we need global integration, but that comes in one of two forms. Either you dissolve the forms of integration that we've relied upon in the past, which is the Marxist method. It's the liberal method. It's the globalist method. And what that will produce is a tiny oligarchy that is not responsible for its actions, because it can effectively remain a cult. And I think that is what we have now. The alternative to that is to embrace the integration that we've relied on in the past and allow that to differentiate us from each other so that we can perform coherent functions within an organic whole as a planet. So I think this, we need to correct the violence of the past, right? I don't think we should embrace might makes right. I think we need to appreciate some of those enlightenment values that brought about the negative aspects of individualism. But we need a resynthesis. And so we need to hearken back to what we were doing before a lot of this social disintegration happened, while still maintaining rapport with the liberal community. I think as well, Greg Johnson, you don't want to identify with one party and one political platform. You want to be ubiquitous. And that means appealing to all of these various groups. So.
Sorry, you've said so much there, I don't know what to pick up on. Would you say that... hold on a second. I just want to make sure of this. Do you actually identify as alt-right?
I do. As a matter of convenience, because the alt-right is a rather large umbrella term, but the core values I share... people have different reasons for sharing these values. Some of it is materialistic for my tastes. I believe in identification with race and ethnicity because they reflect values, transcendent values. You have some higher aspiration and aesthetic. And lacking that, what we go to is the demand of the will, the animalistic will. And you were speaking with Stardust. Is that his name?
Yes.
Yes. You were speaking with him about the differences between white men and black men and how they're appealing to women. And I think what you're looking at in the black race is a tendency towards the effete, the lascivious, and they are sensuously indulgent. They're also typically they're not good with their money. They spend a lot of money. And the reason for that is they have higher time preference, which... many people watching this will be familiar with that concept. It's central to the way that groups choose to develop. And because we value materialism popularly, that black strategy, the more effete strategy that follows the impulse of the will, is being reinforced. So I turn here to religion and to specifically Christianity, because when you have a religious framework that strives after not just attraction, affection, revulsion, primitive acts of the will, but transcends that into the domain of aesthetics and value proper, then you get eugenic tendencies and a social system where people will be selected for reproduction that have aims higher than their own immediate willful ones. And the first step there is recognition of your participation in a group. And I think so the goal here in the end is to gradually expand your capacity for identification. We view as moral someone who looks on the other and their condition as though it was an extension of their own. It's a capacity for empathy that we appreciate at the heart of most moral systems of the world. So the liberal wants to skip the intervening steps to go straight to identification with the broadest possible of in-groups, which is humanity. And I think that if you can't identify properly with that which is most immediate to yourself, then you have no method for training yourself to extend that empathy elsewhere. Like, this is, I think, typified in the church community, which is better than the mainstream, but still the church community that is rife with gossip, cattiness, politics, personal politics. But come Christmas time, they donate all these goods to brown people somewhere else in the world. They don't act in the community. Right. And that is creating a large disconnect.
Yeah. This is a very, very interesting phenomenon, because there is something insincere. Okay. From my perspective, liberal empathy, liberal compassion seems very shallow and insincere. I don't believe that they actually care about black people or poor brown people or whatever. I think they're diuretically determined to care about these people, but they actually don't. Because if they did, they would not move away from an area when those people moved in. And I think this is, in a sense, I think that identitarians like myself probably actually have a deeper respect for other groups than the liberal does, the hysterical liberal who goes out of his way to say that he approves of them and likes them and respects them. I don't think he does. Because he doesn't even, and the core of it is, he doesn't respect his own identity. Therefore, how can he respect anyone else's?
Mm-hmm. I think the leftist tends towards a type of bigotry that people in identitarian circles don't fall into, which is the presupposition of one's own cultural superiority to the level that it falls into the subconscious. They're not aware that what they value is an extension of their biological reality, their race, their people, and the culture that was organically produced by that people, which is why they'll invite in millions upon millions of Muslim migrants with the expectation that these people will naturally want to adopt the values and norms of Western society. It's a profound bigotry and one that I think most leftists are completely ignorant of.
It also relates to their attitude towards culture. I mean, you know, the liberal thinks that it doesn't take much for, let's say, a Nigerian to come over here and just become Western and give up what he previously was. I mean, really? I mean, that's a profound loss to the Nigerian. And I'm not, you know, they're saying, you know, when they talk about integration, this is a sort of schizophrenic thing that exists in the left. And of course, it varies by leftists. Some leftists think that the immigrants should just retain everything, shouldn't integrate at all, really, shouldn't assimilate at all. And others think that they might pay lip service to that, but what they really want is just for every Nigerian, every Pakistani, every Congolese to become exactly like us.
Those who claim not to want integration of these people are falling into an opposite bigotry, which is the presupposition that one's own culture could not possibly be destroyed, or the things that one values could not be destroyed, because it's beyond the experimental realm for them. It's in a deep level of just axiomatic faith, and they have axiomatic faith in the fundamentals of Western society without recognizing what Western society is and how it's continued to survive. They think they're beyond the need to fight for survival. And I think it's that existential aspect that is shortly going to have to come to the fore. Obviously, these terrorist incidents like the massacre in Berlin are bringing that to mind, and it speaks at a level that logic can't. So while I came into some of these views due to my interest in Western philosophy, and also the outreach of people like yourself on YouTube and other forums online. I've lost my train of thought. But on that note, Western society, I think there is a certain urge then to correct this by trying to take back Western society and make Western society Western and white again. And I think that there's a reason that this is taking place. There's a historical inertia, and it's part of a larger process. And you and I have a mutual admiration of Adam Wallace and what he does with his YouTube channel. And he talks about traditionalism and Julius Evola in this type of reasoning. And one of the concepts there is the cycle of the ages. So what we're experiencing now is the senescence of Western civilization to produce the soil out of which the seeds that we will sow will grow. And that means the end of Western civilization, which has become the global civilization. It means a form of a collapse. And Julius Evola, for one, sees the only real viable way out of this in producing those seeds which will grow in the ruins of the world that is to come. So I fall into a alternative variety of fatalism from Stardust. I don't think that society will carry on and just become less white. I think we're going to reach a critical mass because the liberals are really the white supremacists without realizing it. I think most white identitarians are not white supremacists because they recognize the fragility of our condition. Once that fragility is inescapable to recognize, well, things are going to change rapidly. And at that point, we are going to need charismatic leadership, which I think, you know, this community is that which will foster that. If it's not one of the people who have already been your guests now, then it's someone who's probably listening to it.
Well, that's an encouraging thought. Do you think that this is self-correcting then? I mean, this whole malaise that we're in. That's a dreadfully broad question. I'm sorry. Let's go back one step. What is the malaise that we're in?
Well, like I said, it's the decaying of... Well, it's the transvaluation of values. We've been living off of a Judeo-Christian ideological framework with customs and cultural practices derived from largely the Germanic tradition. I think people underestimate the extent to which ethnically modern Europeans are really Scandinavian. I'm just looking at the population history there. But anyway, so we've been relying on these things for our way of life. And they are being called into question explicitly in philosophical circles. You talk about the nihilism that's unacknowledged often and this malaise and this kind of hopelessness. But there's also people actively out there advocating nihilistic philosophical premises, one of which I was. And it wasn't until I encountered some positive values that I really understood the alternative to that malaise. And so I think that's what it is. We're losing... our traditions. And for someone, so obviously nature is aristocratic and hierarchical. So the typical person lives off of the traditions that come from Christianity, and the loss of just that basic, I guess, exoteric Christian layer in people saying Merry Christmas and, you know, looking at the season as an expression of a religious value and an aspiration towards something higher, just those, that basic emotive aspect. Once that's lost, it incurs a great deal of depression. Cause I think people, the common people intuitively feel that that is the death of something fundamental to their own identity and way of life. So yeah, I mean, it's the death of institutions that we've relied upon. I think that is inevitable, because there's a process of self-reflection that Western civilization has gone through uniquely. And that's why we are accepting in millions of people who do not share our heritage, whereas other parts of the world are not. We had Socrates. We had someone as our kind of spiritual exemplar who questioned the axioms and sage advice of those who knew. Right? In China, that's not the case. You have Confucius and you have all these competing, sophists, putting forward what they see as representative of either the perennial tradition that they're involved with. Anyway, there's this assumption that the wise old man has something important to say, and that advice is just trusted. And that breeds social stability, which is why East Asia is still relatively stable. Now, the Western influence has gotten in there, and it will plant its seed and produce largely the same effects that it produced here. But it started here because we were self-reflective first. So this process of self-reflection interferes with a fundamental way that authority works. Once you begin to question why authority is the way it is, you destroy that authority. Yeah, authority must remain unquestioned.
Yes, indeed. Which is that statement would outrage any liberal, I think, because it's interesting. It's almost like you've just explained liberalism. It's this or described it, because as soon as you question authority, you start to corrode it. You start to corrode the illusion of its permanence, and that's the bubble has burst. Then,
right, because it's irrational drives that produce that relation. I mean, there's a form of hypnotism actually at work when you have a charismatic figure. And there's a suspension of the identity of the individual watching, like an Adolf Hitler. There's a suspension of their own identity and a surrender to that other individual. And it's completely irrational factors of the psyche that are producing that phenomenon, the real phenomenon of authority. But we don't acknowledge that. We believe in the logic that we use to cover up the irrationality of that urge to follow sources of authority or traditions. There's a charisma of the institution of the mass and of various ritualistic practices. And we have our rationalizations for it. But the problem is when you try to investigate the phenomenon itself through the rationalism, you come to its ground, the ground of the rationalistic framework, and you realize that it always comes down to fundamental axioms, first principles, which cannot be justified through further rationalization. So that leads to nihilism, because there's a realization that, well, we worship reason. Even the person who worships Christ believes they're worshiping reason because they believe in the truth of what was spoken by Christ and what's in the Bible. Now, they are following the same instinct for logic and empiricism and reason that the scientist is following. It's just that their fundamental premises differ from that of the scientist. So anyway, I don't think it's a negative thing that this process of questioning ourselves has gone on. Because, well, when you observe a system, you change it, right? And I think that's the only way that systems really do change. I think we overestimate the extent to which our own conscious agency can really affect things. But increasing the scope of our knowledge does a lot. I mean, merely staring at a page and absorbing the words that are in there, the act of going through that enough times will dramatically open up the realm of your possible action, which is why people who read go places in life. And, you know, that's something I learned, unfortunately, too late, I believe. But yeah, so we've opened up that realm of possibility. And I think that is really where we are. Senescence of Western civilization means a lot of fertile soil. And the person who understands how these groups form, how authority more or less works, what traditions mean, and where they come from, that person will be able to establish something that will last. Because, yeah, the prevailing institution certainly will not.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, it's sometimes frightening to think, to wonder which institutions are actually going to survive this. Because we don't yet know the scale of the destruction that's on the way, and even the time frame. But I personally think it's going to be a lot sooner than, well, I think it's going to be sooner rather than later. And I think the scale of it is going to be massive, because I can see that the ingredients for the detonation are in such large quantities and are so, so powerful, so potent, and the possibilities for ameliorating their differences are so few and ineffectual that it's going to be a massive explosion. That's how I see it. And to be more specific, I don't think, well, it's as you just said, you know, once you have questioned an authority, which, for example, at the most fundamental level, the authority of Western civilization to perpetuate itself, the right, and the righteousness of that. Once you've questioned that, Western civilization actually doesn't really have much, it's just not going to perpetuate itself. It's just not going to happen.
The only things that will perpetuate themselves are the purely materialistic aspects of our civilization. And those are the things that are exported rather easily. People love adopting Western technologies. But yeah, the irrational drives that created the production chains and the communities that first developed these technologies, those are not as easily exported. And as you say, once they're questioned, they lose their vitality. But I'm sorry, you were going to go on?
Well, yeah, I think that those necessarily belong to a particular group, and that's why you can't. I think it's very, very, even on the face of it, it even sounds like it's going to be very difficult for one ethnic group, or well, let's say one race, to adopt the culture of another race. And as it happens, it is very difficult. I mean, I've asked several people this, and they can't really come up with examples. I posed it to Sargon. It was one of the questions that was asked to him, and he couldn't really think of any examples of where one group has voluntarily adopted wholesale the culture of another group. It just doesn't seem to happen. And I think that's very, telling.
It only really happens in collapsing civilizations. So it happens in ancient Rome when Roman citizenship is granted to the whole of the empire, and you lose the cultural cohesion that had kept these separate regions what they were. There is a surrender of identity that goes into some aspects of Persian history. These large multicultural empires, when they do reach a nihilistic phase where, okay, what does Roman citizenship mean now that we're all Romans? What differentiates us as a distinct people? Who are we? And once you lose that identity, it's only the materialistic aspect that orients society. And this is where you get dysgenic tendencies, because the person who is able most to satisfy materialistic needs will be the person who has the strongest desire for it, and therefore the person most fit for reproduction, because they have the most stuff, is the person most drawn by their own will. And that's, I'd maybe like to segue a little bit into, I think, the religious framework that must continue. I think there's a seed in Christianity of a tradition that goes back as far as written history, certainly, and probably much, much further. And it can be described as the perennial philosophy or the type religion. Many people have come upon this concept, but there's a fundamental similarity of the ethical systems of the world and the rejection of the will, and actually, to a certain extent, the rejection of worldliness and the world in a larger sense. When you have that surrender of your own will and the tendencies that it leads you to, again, you open up the field of possibility, and you enable your behavior to be shaped by something beyond the material realm, which there is, to use philosophical jargon, the Platonic realm, the eidetic realm, the realm of mathematics, the realm of ideas. There's something higher than the physical, than causal interaction of material properties. So when you get out of this material chain, and this is another reason why I really appreciate Adam Wallace, he emphasizes that it starts from the individual. So while on a certain level, we have to look to the integration of the globe and what that will look like, and we will face a collapse. I think that's likely, if not inevitable. And we have to worry about what it'll look like, but really you have to worry about your own spiritual nature, and you can't just look upon religion and authority and tradition from a Machiavellian perspective. You have to think about the truth of it. And I think that search for the truth of it is really what has driven Western civilization all along. We're truth seekers, I think, beyond the level that other peoples have realized thus far. That's why I am a Christian, because the Christian religion has preserved that tradition, the perennial philosophy. And it's done so in a way that does not require erudition or a great deal of rational capacity or intuition or understanding. It's the most simple possible directive. Have faith in this man. And I think that's what all movements really come down to. Have faith in this man who you recognize as being higher than yourself. And once you get that humility, that opens the door for really changing your behaviors. A lot of people become addicted to tobacco. I was addicted to cigarettes for a while. And if you don't believe that something is beyond yourself, like if you don't believe in the authority, for example, this is a mundane example, but the authority of the doctor who says that it will lead to your eventual death, most likely, then what reason do you have for quitting? If you don't believe in the authority of your parents who tell you not to get into it in the first place, then most likely you will. You have to believe in something higher than yourself. And I think it helps if it's a man in particular, because it hits that atavistic element of ourselves, which we rely upon. But if we don't submit that part of ourselves to something higher, eventually controls us. So either you acknowledge a source higher than yourself, an authority higher than yourself, and let that control you. And it can, I think it doesn't have to be Christianity exclusively. I think we have to look to great men. Nature is aristocratic. And actually, that also ties into the relationship between men and women. In the natural condition, the man was the protector. And that martial reason, I think the logic that's necessary, the cold calculating empiricism that's necessary for military success is a male trait because the burden of combat fell upon us. So that has produced a drive towards logical explanation and empiricism that makes us fit leaders. And women, on the other hand, wanted to be protected by these men, and they wanted to nurture the next generation. I mean, we look at the natural condition, we see that women play a subservient role out of biological necessity, because they are the ones who have to minister to the next generation. That's their biological incumbency. So I think, yeah, authority for social systems, and as well authority between the genders. It says in the Bible, in the New Testament, that a woman should treat the words of her husband as if they were the words of God. And I think that actually leads to a happy marriage. Being a married man myself, I do think that if you try to indulge in the pride that many women have in not wanting to be conquered, they're never going to respect you. They're never going to be happy, because they, in their mind, well, perhaps at a subconscious level, but they will think that they've not found a man who is actually able to live up to the masculine virtue, which is to dominate their superiors and inferiors. The male nature, when it realizes itself, is a superior one. And of course, I think there's a female aspect in each of us, and that's why, you know, submit yourself to the man who more fully realizes the masculine principle than yourself. But
yeah, I think this is a very real thing. Again, in our age, this is an exotic novelty. It's a sort of astonishing, baffling treasure to realize that women really want to be dominated. You know, they want an authority figure, and it's also not good enough just to assert yourself and just to claim, you know, just I am an authority figure, because she knows you're pretending. She knows you're insecure. She knows you're desperate if you say something like that. This is something that I think men need to be trained in, because and they're not now. So and hence you have a lot of just go nowhere relationships. It needs to be genuine. You know, the guy actually needs to deserve respect and deserve to hold authority.
Yeah, you have to show that you're a source of authority.
Exactly,
sure,
not just
tell,
declare it.
Right.
Precisely. And I think it's also the same between men as well, as you were saying earlier. Men want leadership, but they don't want some blowhard who just wants to be in charge for the sake of it. They want someone who is competent and can handle situations and deliver the goods. And I think that men are actually extremely good at sensing that, without even having to really work it out. You know, again, this is another myth of our time, that men calculate things. You know, I don't think that's true. I think men are very intuitive, just in a different way, a radically different way from the way women are intuitive. But there was another thing I wanted to ask you about. Yes, I just wanted to point out that when you were talking about authority, and one thing that was implicit in your statements is that people need to be led, and even crave to be led. It occurred to me that is just so contrary to the myths of our age. You know, the other day I was speaking to Sargon of Akkad, and I like Sargon. I'm not making fun of him here, but it interested me that he was so obsessed with democracy, and he had this assertion, he had this belief that people want to be in control of their rulers or the politicians. And I thought, you know, I mean, even as I say it now, I'm realizing how contradictory that statement is. Why would you want to be in control of the people who are supposed to be in control of you? Yeah, I mean, that is kind of ridiculous. And I think that this is, do you think this is in itself part of decline, democracy? I mean, because it does seem to be a breakdown of natural order.
I would say so. I think there's a fractious instinct in the child as it develops, and in women before they really understand the feminine virtue fully. There is the drive of our primitive animalistic wills, which most species, and I happen to, I call myself a Christian, and I believe in the authority of Christ. I also believe in many of the other tenets of the perennial philosophy, like reincarnation. And I think even if you're just a strict materialist and believe in the influence of our genes, most of our genetics comes from a time when animals, we weren't mammals for the majority of our conditioning. We didn't rely upon the emotional instincts that keep our communities together and our lives comfortable and full of meaning. It's a cold, hard world out there, right? So that fractious instinct comes from the drive that we each have, the most fundamental drive to protect ourselves from threats, and to get those things that sustain our life. But again, that's a dark, deep place in us that must be overcome, in order that we can, become what we can be. And it's that becoming what we can be, which people don't see as being reliant upon authority, but I think it is. I was trained as a classical musician, and if you think that you can figure out, a craft that was developed over hundreds and hundreds of years on your own without trusting in the authority of a teacher. Actually, the Latin term, whence authority is derived, auctoritas, means precisely the authority that is lent to an instructor, by the pupil. So yeah, authority is the key to individuation, in Carl Jung's sense of the term, finding a differentiated role for yourself within an organic whole. And that's what makes us happy. I've known several friends now that found the jobs that they wanted and feel fulfilled in life. And just from looking at them, just from observing how their mannerisms change after they attain that, that is what satisfies. And the path to that is sacrificing those childish instincts that we each have to think me, me, me. Now, there's an inversion of that process of individuation, which is advertised by it's in popular culture in many, many places, but it's the special snowflake generation. Believe it, conceive it, achieve it, follow your dreams. All of that is oriented to the individual and their drives. What it should say is follow your calling. The Germans, you know, have that concept of your profession being a calling. Follow what you're apt for and seek out the authority of someone who has mastered it before yourself.
Yes. I mean, that's a very interesting thing. It just occurred to me there that the word vocation is not used anymore. I don't hear it. I remember even 15 years ago that you would hear that word. It's not just her job, it's her vocation, you know, or an equivalent thing like that. That word seems to have fallen by the wayside. I think that's, there must be some significance. I mean, a word doesn't fall out of use for no reason. It tends to, you know, ebb and flow with the currents of the culture in which it's used. And that, it does fascinate me. I think that I might have to make a video about that, just exploring that fact. I mean, I know that other people might be saying, well, I hear that word now and then. But it just occurs to me that when you say follow your calling, that is, you know, another word for that would be, you know, find your vocation, find the thing that your calling demands of you. And that is implicitly saying you are limited by your own nature. You were born to do something. You know, your purpose is encoded in your very being. You just need to identify it. That's a very different lesson from the one that I would say is more commonplace now, which is, just do what you feel like and do 10 things. Have switched careers 3 or 4 times in your life. And thus become yourself an amalgamation of experiences and possibilities, which is, you know, that's really nice and upbeat and pretty. But I don't think it's actually honest. I think most people are quite hard-coded. And, that's why they get depressed when they're not finding out what they're actually supposed to do in life, what their purpose is.
Right. I'm a big fan of Arthur Schopenhauer, the German idealist philosopher, and he had a view of language that I think reflects what you're saying. There's a reason why words come into being, and there's a reason why words fall out of common usage. And they encode the wisdom of a people, right? So what you're describing in terms of the modern person following their desires, right? Do what you want. YOLO, you only live once. Change your majors. It's a matter of your mere preference, your whims, right? You do what you want with your life. And the alternative to that is following this more archaic sense of what a profession means and all that. But I think the pathway there actually may be through this sense of following your whim, and that's what I started with. The subjective preference for your own people cannot be illegitimated through the intellectual apparatus of the left. That's why I came into this way of thinking in the first place. That's why I listened to the white nationalists, because they have their whim. They want their life to be a certain way. It doesn't just come down to themselves as an individual, but they want to group together with others that they see as being like themselves in some particular way. And why shouldn't they be allowed to do that? Within the liberal ethos, there is no reason for that that provision against ethnic solidarity. It's only the bare repetition of bad racist that keeps people away from that worldview.
And and even in practice, I don't think it really does keep them away from that. It doesn't keep them away from practicing that worldview. It keeps them from thinking that worldview and voicing it. You know, in practice, most people do group together, and they do find a neighborhood where everyone else is basically like them. It's this is why Section 8 housing has had to be mandated, because people on their own just don't mix. I mean, again, I was in America recently. I traveled around a lot. I was at Berkeley and UC Davis and several other university campuses. And I don't think that mixing is, I don't think it comes naturally to people, which is not to say that it's always a bad thing. I think, you know, interchange is perfectly natural and right. But I don't think it comes naturally to people. And when you, I think therefore that it sort of, to do it at a, to encourage it at a deep level, i.e., for example, race mixing, is contrary to human nature. I don't think people like it. But I've forgotten how I got into this. I hope it was linked to what you just said somehow.
Oh, yeah, absolutely it was. So anyway, probably we should close up relatively soon here. I would just say, in closing, I'm optimistic for the prospects of white identity, especially since white people control the Northern Hemisphere. However much that may be changing, we might project out 50 years seeing ourselves as minorities in certain places. Siberia is ours. Europe is still ours. North America is still ours. If there's a social collapse, who controls the land? Who has weapons? Who is actually physically in a position to capitalize on what comes next? It's us. And well, I think we shouldn't forget that.
Even at a physical level, we are evolved for these climates.
Right. It's hard to overcome the adaptations that come with being the native people of a region. Mm. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of cause for optimism, but also a lot of cause for precaution and putting yourself in a position where you, as an individual, will be able to survive what comes next. And I think a lot of that, I wouldn't call myself a prepper, but you have to have firearms. You have to have food and a way of defending your family. And you have to live in a place that is not just like safe in the event of some kind of societal collapse, but also environmentally sustainable. Because what we're doing may not last just in economic terms. The price of oil may become too high. Alternative energies might not work out. We shouldn't have absolute faith in this system, especially when it's a system that we're ideologically opposed to in many ways. I think, yeah, be the alternative. And I think, you know, Greg Johnson talks about creating institutions and we need, you know, someone working the desk and answering the phone. And that's true. That function needs to be performed. But we also need people out there forming communities, because there really is nothing preventing us from doing so. It's really just the prejudice of mass opinion looking unfavorably on that kind of voluntary community in a number of ways. I mean, ideologically, even just strict, like intentional communities, communes, there's a stigma against. And I think that stigma is there to prevent people from providing alternative to the power structure that exists, which is this globalist one that's interested in transhumanism and turning themselves into immortal robots or whatever they want to do, something very unnatural, against nature. So that natural procedure, going out and forming a colony and having a foundational ethos and myth and, you know, being that frontier people, I think that's the real threat to them, that organic alternative. And that's what I think fascism could have been. I think we've lost that opportunity, and we're not going to have nationalist uprisings like we could have had in the 1930s. But the alternative is to start from a more fundamental level and build what comes next. And I think that falls on us. And I personally intend on doing it myself, going out there and getting my hands dirty.
Well, excellent. And I hope that you will, in one way or another, take this community with you in that endeavor. So I'll leave it there then. And I hope that you come on the channel again at some point. It's obvious that there is a lot that we could discuss, a huge amount. I've certainly got that feeling from this conversation. So hopefully we'll do that in the next year or so.
So yeah, absolutely. Merry Christmas. Thank you for having me.
Excellent. Thank you, Eric Orwell. And thank you, everyone, for listening. Next up is Davis MJ Orini. See you soon.